This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Protocol for Life Balance, offering a wide range of professional-grade supplements using ingredients backed by strong scientific research. Among them, two stand out, which help nourish your brain: Protosorb Magnesium and Cogumin SLCP. Protosorb Magnesium features a patented form of magnesium that easily crosses the blood-brain barrier, delivering magnesium directly to your brain. Cogumin SLCP features optimized curcumin, which also allows free curcumin to cross the blood-brain barrier. Protosorb Magnesium and Cogumin SLCP are highly innovative products that help nourish your brain. They're only available from healthcare practitioners, but they're available to you at drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's topic is integrative cardiology. With me today is an integrative cardiologist and wellness expert with a practice in West Long Branch, New Jersey. She is Dr. Vivian Caminos. She's clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. It's part of the University of Arizona School of Medicine. So she teaches and also writes curricula for their fellowship program, which I'm happy to hear, now is about integrative medicine. She's also a founding member of the American Board of Integrative Medicine. And she obtained her MD from St. Louis University. She did her internal medicine cardiology fellowship at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital right here in New Jersey. So, Vivian, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ron. And I'm honored to be among your guests. I've been listening to your podcast, and I'm thrilled with it. I want to applaud the work you're doing in educating our public and hopefully more physicians in integrative medicine, the medicine of the future and the real medicine.
Right. Well, you know, I really take it as high praise from you because you have an interesting career arc. You're rigorously trained in conventional medicine. In fact, you practiced what is called invasive cardiology. Well, that doesn't sound good. You know, things, we don't like things that are invasive, but sometimes we have to be aggressive in treating patients. And now you've moved to a sort of a more soft medicine approach to cardiology. Tell us about your personal journey.
Sure. I wouldn't exactly call integrated medicine soft. I actually think it's the real hard medicine. But yeah, let me tell you a little bit about my training. You know, I trained in a university program, and the cardiology training is basically centered on diagnostic testing. And when I was done with fellowship, I thought I was a really good operator in the cath lab. So I performed angiograms, cardiac catheterizations, and I was good at it. I enjoyed them. Yep. I was working, started my own practice, working pretty hard, probably, you know, equivalent of 60 hours a week plus, getting up in the middle of the night, treating people with heart attacks, heart failure, arrhythmias.
We call that blood and guts medicine. You know, it's like heroic interventions to save lives in the middle of the night.
And, you know, Ron, it was a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, it is.
But I was getting a little bit tired. And about 15 years into my career, heart disease hit my home. And here I was back in the cath lab, but on the other side of the cath table in the control booth, watching as balloons and stents were being inserted into my husband. And when I saw that, something in me just cracked. I felt like the floor just gave out underneath me. And I felt like an awful cardiologist, because here I was with a husband that had heart disease. So not only was I a terrible wife, I was also a terrible cardiologist. And
you had a sense that you had failed him because he was there in extremis, and you wish you'd perhaps had headed it off at the pass.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I don't know why it took me you know, that long to realize that what I was doing was simply diagnosing heart disease and temporizing heart disease, but I really wasn't doing enough to prevent it or cure it. And, you know, in the search for what was happening to my husband and to my patients, I went to a nutrition conference in Tucson. This was back in 2004. And at the conference, I met this, you know, big guy with a very large white beard called Andrew Weil. I had no idea who he was. Yeah. I didn't know who he was.
Strange looking
and,
guy.
You know, I talked to him. Yeah, he's a great guy. But anyway, I talked to him a little bit. And at that conference, I learned about integrative medicine. I had no idea what integrative medicine was. And I thought, isn't this amazing? I can actually learn lifestyle medicine and medicine that's not Western medicine, like acupuncture, mind body, botanicals. I can learn other things. And maybe that is the reason why some people have heart disease and other chronic diseases. So that's a little bit of, what happened to me on my personal journey. And I did this 2-year fellowship at the Dr. Andrew Weil Center for Integrated Medicine. Then got very involved with it. You know, I bitterly complained about the cardiology content, and I was in the fellowship 2005 to 2007. And at that time, we really didn't have a lot of evidence for integrative medicine, but over the last, you know, decade, we've collected a lot more evidence. And I got so involved in giving them curricula and my opinions that I was lucky enough to be invited
to join the faculty. So the student became the teacher, in effect. You actually ended up revamping their curriculum.
Oh, yeah.
And teaching a new approach
somewhat
to integrative cardiology.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm very proud of the fellowship. It constantly challenges me. The participants, the doctors, the nurse practitioners, the physician assistants that are in it are constantly challenging us and doing research. And it's just absolutely wonderful what's happened. And, you know, going back to my husband, here was a man who had very low cholesterol.
Yep.
His inflammatory markers were non-existent. And yet he had this, you know, 99% blockage in a major artery. And, you know, we took him to a preventive cardiologist that was the Maha of all preventive cardiologists, who basically threw his hands up and said, gee, I don't know what you should do.
Yep.
Maybe you should drink a glass of red wine. Well,
okay.
That's not enough.
Yeah.
That wasn't enough. So, you know, as it turns out, there was a lot of stress in our lives. We were both working hard, full time, raising a child. I was working twice time, I guess, not full time, raising a child. And also, we had gotten away from my roots. You know, I grew up with, I'm the first one born to Greek immigrants.
Okay.
First one in my family born in the United States.
So you were like one generation removed from the traditional Mediterranean diet.
But I wasn't removed because my yaya cooked all our meals.
Oh.
I think I was in fourth grade before I ate a hot dog or knew what a French fry was. You know, I at home we would have like stuffed zucchini blossoms or fish soup or bean soup. And if we kids didn't eat what Yaya put on the table, we didn't eat. So I grew up with a traditional Mediterranean diet. But with growing up in this country and then becoming busy, we got away from it. At least I got away from it. And, you know, here I was feeding my son and my husband, you know, hot dogs and, you know, boxed macaroni and cheese. I'm really embarrassed to say that. So I had to change. And, you know, my husband having heart disease and then doing the fellowship really taught me how to be a better doctor.
Okay. Did you ever determine if he had a specific genetic or metabolic risk factor for cardiovascular disease? Because sometimes something obscure is the trigger for cardiovascular problems, such as Lp(a) or homocysteine or C-reactive protein, one of those things that is less frequently checked.
Right. Right, right. So his C-reactive protein was less than one. He has no LPA that's elevated.
Okay.
And homocysteine was normal.
Uh-oh.
So I'm glad you're bringing
it's
up all
enigma.
Those things.
Yeah.
But it's not so much of an enigma, because remember what we know in terms of the risks for heart disease. The traditional risk factors only account for a percent of people, you know, a small percent of people that have heart disease.
Right.
So, as it turns out, a lot of the men in his family had heart disease in their 50s, the way he did. So, you know, there was a definite genetic predisposition, and, you know, that was part of it. And again, I'm convinced that our lifestyle played a major role in it, because we were working too hard, we were too stressed, and we weren't eating well. We were exercising, but you can't just do one thing right and have it cure the other ills.
You know, and I know very well, because during my medical training, one of the top cardiologists at NYU, I mean, he virtually saw half the patients there, and the other 25 cardiologists saw the other half. He was a real workhorse, and he was the go-to guy. He really would show up at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning if a patient was going down the tubes, worked tremendously hard, died of a massive heart attack at the age of 52. That lifestyle is really not conducive to cardiovascular wellness.
It certainly isn't. And I think I was headed in that direction also, because I was also the one that got up with the phone call and ran in. And, you know, luckily we were able to change our lifestyle. And, you know, luckily I was embraced by the Integrative Medicine Fellowship and by my peers that also believed in integrative medicine. And, you know, basically, you know, changed my practice. So now my practice is, you know, on wellness and integrative cardiology. And, but I still see people with aortic stenosis and atrial fibrillation and, you know how to
problems.
Treat them.
Yeah. Well,
right.
Okay. So let's define our terms here a little bit. You're an integrative cardiologist. So for example, when confronted with a patient with hypertension, how might your approach differ from that of a mainstream cardiologist?
Oh, okay. So, you know, hypertension, as you know, affects almost half of the population. You know, unfortunately, the way that hypertension is even initially diagnosed is incorrect. Because what happens when patients go to the office, they're waiting, they're getting upset, you know, a medical assistant throws them on a gurney or something, and they get this drive-by blood pressure, right?
Yeah.
And most in-office blood pressure may not be accurate. In fact, most people don't even know how to check a blood pressure. So the first thing I did was learn how to check a blood pressure. And the first thing I do with a patient when I see them, after I obtain a complete history and I you know, their whole background, their lifestyle, all their habits, what I do is I sit them in a chair, feet flat on the floor, back supported, and I breathe with them. I teach them a relaxing breath after the cuff is on, and I let them know we're going to be breathing together, and then I check their blood pressure. And I check it a couple times. I check it on both sides so that I can get an accurate reading. The most accurate way to diagnose hypertension is with ambulatory blood pressure readings, but most people hate those. I used to do them in the office, and they'd come back and bitterly complain.
It's a device that you take home and you walk around with, but it's kind of a nuisance.
Well, it's a nuisance because it inflates, and you can feel it even while you're asleep. So you can't sleep with it. At least I wouldn't be able to.
Yeah.
But in any case, I'll do a proper measurements in the office. I have my patients then get a blood pressure machine for home use that I check for accuracy, and have them monitor it every day if I have an elevated reading. So I don't automatically put them on medications unless they have blood pressure that's very high, or I feel they're at risk.
Yeah,
at
like 212 or 130, I think you're probably going to give them something before they go home.
I think so. I think they'd go right to the ER with 212 or 130.
Yeah.
But in any case, so the measurement's very important. And, you know, so I don't want to minimize that. And then what we do is we talk about, you know, everything in terms of lifestyle. Exercise is sort of at the top of most of my recommendations. You know, I don't care where you start. Like if you start, you're sedentary, you're sick, we'll find something that you can do. If you're an athlete, you know, we review the exercise program and we see what you're doing that might be good for blood pressure, might not be good for blood pressure. So definitely
maybe you don't want to go on an inversion board or something like that if you have high blood pressure, because it can raise your intracranial pressure, put you at risk for a stroke. So maybe, you know, like headstands and yoga may not be the ticket for somebody with very high blood pressure.
Not what I would recommend. The same way I wouldn't recommend like heavy weight training. So it's interesting
bench
about
pressing
when
350,
they did a,
you know, it's not great because your eyeballs are going to pop out.
But you know, lifting a little weight.
Yeah.
And reps. Walking is not dangerous. In fact, it's more dangerous to not do it.
Right.
So, you know, after an exercise session, your blood pressure can go down by up to, you know, 14 hours to 20 hours. It's amazing. Another thing I do is I use biofeedback with a device that people could buy online called Respirate. Have you heard of that?
Yes. The Respirate.
Respirate is this great little box that's connected to a belt that you attach to your chest or your abdomen. And then you put earphones in the box and you turn it on. It tells you breathe in and breathe out. And what it does is it recruits your in-breath, your out-breath, so that it coaches you into breathing only 6 breaths a minute. You breathe slowly, you breathe deeply, and that recruits the parasympathetic nervous system, which is relaxing and which decreases heart rate, decreases blood pressure, decreases the stress hormones. In fact, the FDA has approved it for treatment of hypertension, and you know, no drugs involved. And the other thing we use obviously is food. And supplements, you know, my favorite supplements for, blood pressure or beetroot, beetroot powder for nitrates, right. Ubiquinol, or CoQ10, the reduced form of CoQ10 that's absorbed better, magnesium, where most of us are magnesium deficient, and omega-3 fatty acids. Most Americans are also deficient in omega-3 fatty acids. And, you know, I try to figure out if I've already taught them a relaxing breath. I try to figure out if they're, you know, open to meditation. And the other thing, too, is to get a personalized approach. You know, so I've been offering genomics in my practice, which started as a need, because patients were coming to me with these printouts of all their genetic variants. I don't know if you've had that, where you know, there's these direct to consumer products where, you know, you'll get a bunch of SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, and they come in and they show them to you, and you look at them and you say, okay, what do I do with this? So there's a platform I use that I love, Intellix DNA,
which I'm using as well.
Which what I love about it, and probably you do too, you know, it takes hundreds of SNPs, but it puts them in pathways that make sense. So for instance, there's a hypertension pathway, there's a diabetes pathway, an obesity pathway. So some of my patients, I had a young guy who was hypertensive and who's at risk for Alzheimer's disease, who wanted this test. He did it. And I found out that he can't break down his catecholamines, and he has certain SNPs that put him at higher risk if I have him on calcium channel blockers. And
so he had a COMT variant.
Yeah, and he wasn't breaking down. You know, he had these adrenal receptors that were constantly firing.
Right.
So I forget the name of the SNP, but it was another SNP he had. So he lacked, actually. So, you know, what I did was I took him off his calcium channel blockers. As it turns out, he didn't need.
Yeah.
He cut down his medication after a healthier lifestyle. So there's a lot we do that's different.
Right.
You know, this
but
doesn't happen.
What's interesting, about that
Intellix
test is that it actually can, you know, should there be a need for a blood pressure medication, you know, as you well know, the process by which we target patients with blood pressure medications, a little bit like throwing darts at a dartboard. We kind of start with, you know, the lightest thing, and then we go up. And it's a little bit random. And with a test like the Intellix DNA, it can sometimes suggest, What type of high blood pressure, among the many different subtypes of high blood pressure a person has, whether they're more suited for a beta blocker, whether they could respond to what's called an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, just like you, I'm loath to prescribe medication, but sometimes patients need it, and it helps us have a little better targeting.
That's right. And I find this very helpful because, like you said, we just throw a dart. And what happens when you start a medication and it doesn't work? What do? You add another medication.
Yeah.
And then you add another medication. And then we have these problems with polypharmacy where we don't know what's working and not working anymore. And, you know, one of the things that I found when I was practicing in my practice was I'd see patients who are on, 10, 15 medications, and they're just added on one after another, and maybe the first and second one is not necessary anymore.
Mm-hmm. No, we do. But we see that all the time.
Physicians are loath to stop medication often. We do try. I do use medications, obviously, but I try to limit it and, try to use it appropriately. So, I like this genomics platform, so it's really good.
Good. Yeah. So one of your in talking to you before, I realized that one of your pet peeves is that while one of the most important pathways for treating cardiovascular disease is nutrition, very few cardiologists or physicians in general really have any training in nutrition. What do you say to that?
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. You know, a friend of mine, Stephen DeVries, who's also an integrative cardiologist, there's only a handful of us in the country, but Stephen's a great guy who also trained at Arizona. He conducted a survey of 930 cardiologists and basically asked some questions. You know, what kind of training did you have through medical school, residency, fellowship, and how do you feel about nutrition? And, you know, most cardiologists, over 90%, said that they received absolutely no training of nutrition during their fellowship, and I'm one of those. And about 30 to 60% had no training in medical school or residency. I remember that in medical school I had probably two lectures, and the only thing I remembered from it was that A, D, E, K were fat-soluble vitamins, so they were very dangerous, you know?
Right, you got to watch out because you can overdose on those.
Yeah. Oh, right. So there was really no training. And yet, you know, most cardiologists will agree with you and me that nutrition's a cornerstone of therapy. So, you know, there's a disconnect there. What is it that we believe and what tools are we given? So, you know, luckily now there's more options for physicians and other medical practitioners to go out and get training. I don't know that option was there when I was in training. And also, you know, nutrition has really changed over the last, you know, how it's changed in terms of what we recommend to our cardiac patients. You know, years and years ago when I first started practicing, I hate to tell you when that was, but it was 1989. What was the American Heart Association telling us to do? No fat, right?
Yeah,
low
it was.
Fat,
in fact,
no
it was.
Fat.
I actually and distinctly I, remember that one of my professors, who was a cardiologist, he used to brag to us that he would take a little shot glass and fill it up with corn oil, and take a shot of corn oil every day, because it was a beneficial polyunsaturated fat. That was the state of the art. I think this must have been in the 1980s.
Is he the one that actually had the heart attack at 55?
No. I from time to time, I check up on him. I don't see him anymore. So I hope he didn't meet his maker prematurely.
Well, I'll tell you what's even worse. You know, my I had patients come in to me who would say, this is great. I just had, you know, you've fixed me. I just had the angioplasty. We weren't even doing stents yet. And I found these great cookies and I could eat the whole box because there's no fat in them.
They're
fat
free.
And they were snacks.
Yeah.
Snack Well cookies. What was in there? It was high fructose corn syrup. Mm. You know, when you get rid of fat, you have to replace it with another nutrient. So, you know, thanks to these guidelines, we were really, really causing a lot of heart disease. And, you know, it was really a dangerous and awful diet. Luckily, we've advanced quite a bit in terms of nutrition research. And, you know, now, even though the American Heart Association is still putting limits on the amount of saturated fat, you know, fat is not demonized in the way that it was. And, you know, I'd love to talk to you about what I feel about nutrition research, if you have a minute.
Well, absolutely. Let's save that for part two, because I want to do a deeper dive on some of the major nutrition controversies that really bedevil cardiology these days. Because on the one hand, you have, you know, the low-fat acolytes. They're hanging in there pretty well. But also you have people who support paleo dieting and keto diets for cardiovascular prevention. So we'll approach that controversy in part two of today's interview with Dr. Vivian Kaminos. Dr. Kaminos, in case people don't have time to jump over to part two, which we urge them to do, your practice, West Long Branch, New Jersey, is their website?
Yes. They could read about me and my practice on www.drkaminos.com. That's DrKominos, drkaminos.com. And all the information is there.
Okay, great. So stay with us, folks. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we'll be right back with more of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast.